Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for the week ending Friday, the 11th of August. A podcast which does not lag, at least not after the edit. Why am I making a lag joke, Matt?
Because we're in different parts of the world, and in our efforts to achieve what President George W. Bush would have called global reach, we're spreading out. It's all part of the master plan.
It is. And it's been very enjoyable, actually. So I think personally, and I'd love to know from if listeners had a view on this, whether we should do more Two Mats podcasts.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do two a week. And if we can do it remotely, then that's perfectly possible. We'll have to discuss that with our wonderful producer, Matt Hill.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so what did we talk about this week?
We did it so no one else would have to. We looked at Lee Anderson, deputy chair of the Conservative Party, and his ridiculous statements about migration, and tried to ask if we were being played or not. And then upliftingly, we said goodbye to two great culture heroes, Jamie Rhee, the designer, and William Friedkin, the director of The French Connection and The Exorcist, both of whom died this week.
And we came up with our own lists of cultural icons, didn't we?
Which I thought was fascinating. And I hope people will go to at the Two Mats on Twitter and give us their own recommendations.
So, okay. So this, what are we going to call it, by the way, this show?
It's a good question. Well, we're looking at culture and cults. Anything grab you on that?
Absolute cults. A bunch of cults. How about
a bunch
that?
Of cults.
Okay. So this is the Two Mats, episode 8, A Bunch of cults. Enjoy. So, Matt, what do we want to talk about?
Well, in this, our first virtual episode, which is in itself incredibly exciting, I guess we have to talk about what started as Rishi Sunak, although he's on holiday, launching a kind of stop the boats week with a kind of rollout of one unpleasant announcement a day, and has become Lee Anderson week. And I'm not sure this was the plan.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm pretty sure it wasn't the plan. So I guess to recap, it started with an interview in The Express in which Lee Anderson, who is a familiar figure to readers of The New European and I'm sure to lots of listeners of The Two Mats, which deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, represents a red wall seat, Ashfield, and incarnates the spirit of the red wall. So he says to The Express that if asylum seekers don't like it here, they can, quote, fuck off back to France. And this is sort of chapter one in the saga, which we'll discuss, which is the responses from the more effete southern members of the government, which is one of quiet satisfaction, which is that Lee Anderson is saying what they daren't say. So Alex Chalke, the Justice Secretary, says, you know, he wouldn't put it quite like that, but he agrees with the sentiment. Robert Jenrick, the Immigration Minister, does the same. So they're fine with that. And then Lee Anderson goes on Nigel Farage's GB News show. Lee Anderson also has his own GB News show, but for the moment, this is the Farage show. And I wonder if our brilliant producer, Matt Hill, can give us a taste of what Lee said to Nigel.
Listen, Nigel, I'm not going to sit here and make excuses to anyone. This is out of control. We're in power at the moment. I'm as you say, the deputy chair of the Conservative Party. We're in government, and we have failed on this. There's no doubt about it. You know, we said we're going to fix it. It is a failure. Look, we have got policies in place, and I know it's a bit hard for the British public at the moment to actually, you know, understand what we're trying to do with the Rwanda flights and the changing legislation, the illegal migration bill. And it seems very slow. It's cumbersome. We're up against it, Nigel. Let's be honest. We've got the lefty lawyers. We've got the human rights campaigners. We've got the charities. Everything's against us. But no, I'm not making excuses. It's slowing us down.
So that the big what had changed was Lee Anderson expressing exasperation and saying the government has failed. Now, that's a totally different matter. And of course, created a hasty response around Whitehall and the various places that ministers are dispersed for their holidays, saying, no, we haven't failed. Because Rishi Sunak, one of his big objectives is to knock the small boats problem, as he sees it, on the head by the end of 2023. And we're now already well into August. So to have a figure as ubiquitous as Lee Anderson saying you've failed was what they call in Whitehall suboptimal.
I mean, the whole thing I find quite challenging because, you know, Lee Anderson, and by the way, worth just restating this man's position in public life, the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, this guy, this absolute, you know, non-entity. But the challenge it presents is that he is absolutely right. The government has failed over the course of 13 years now in managing this problem. But the paradox for people like us is that we are now doing exactly what they want us to do, which is to talk about this issue, to let this become the wedge when the real issues are elsewhere. You know, it's a bunch of bleeding heart progressive liberals like us, you know, furious. I'll speak for myself, but
no, you speak for me too.
A fellow traveller in that regard, you know, furious about this. It's exactly what they want, because when people like us are moaning about it, the people they want to be rallying around are happy to see that. And it sucks the oxygen out of the room around the real debates and the real challenge. And the real problem is that, you know, there's 160,000 plus people waiting to have their asylum claim processed. And that's gone up from about 40,000 about 5 years ago. And that's the incompetence of Suella Braverman and her predecessors in the Home Office. But that's her. She is an incompetent. If she was in any commercial operation, she'd have been fired years ago as an utter fraud, phony, incompetent. And yet there is this deliberate strategy of obfuscation and distraction. And the barge is one distraction. The latest thing is this bloody, what do they call it? The Professional Enablers Task Force, where they say they're going to sue, quote, dodgy barristers for processing fraudulent asylum claim. Barristers, as if. It's an absolute nonsense. My prediction on that one is that there will be zero prosecutions, but it makes great headlines. And this is the policy of distraction that is succeeding, I'm afraid, in certain parts of the country. And we should take it very seriously, don't you think?
I do. Now, of course, what we really need is a system that works and is fair and humane, and that would cost a lot of money. And Robert Jenrick, the immigration minister, let the cat out of the bag this week because he was asked, well, look, you know, in Germany, the processing takes 6 months. Why does it take years in the UK? And Jenrick said, well, of course, you don't want to have the processing too fast because that would act as an incentive for people to come. So, in fact, as so often with this government, the, you know, we've used this phrase before. It's the title of a very good book on Trump. The cruelty is the point, which is that the idea that if you come here and you get stuck in a long process, which is very disagreeable, bureaucratic, dehumanizing, you know, it that will show you that you shouldn't come here. But it, in fact, it isn't acting as a disincentive. So it's not solving the problem, nor indeed is it really altering the reality, which is that we all know that climate change, conflict and so on are going to increase the question of what to do about refugees around the world. So this is a very, very blinkered, very cynical process. I agree with you. I think that what's going on here is an attempt to get us to pay attention to it, which so arguably we shouldn't be talking about it. But I think that there's another point to make here, which is that Lee Anderson, as I said, has two functions. One is that they used to say that the chairman of the or the chair of the Conservative Party was the minister for the Today programme. And Lee Anderson is the minister for the Daily Express and GB News, if you like. And he performs that function, but he also performs another function, which is contradictory, which is that he is thinking beyond the next election. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he's thinking about his own potential run at the leadership. And so these criticisms of the strength of these criticisms of what has been accomplished so far, which is precisely fuck all, is partly a pitch to the grassroots of the Conservative Party and to the people who will be deciding the identity of the next leader, which is to say in code, I get it. I hear you, I see you, and when this lot, when Sunak and co have gone, we will make sure that we do absolutely everything that's necessary, including, by the way, leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, for which there is a big appetite amongst his kind of Conservative MP and, crucially, Conservative members who, as we know, have the final say in Tory leadership contests.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to say something that might be controversial or unexpected. To me, the barge is not the problem. The problem, and yes, I'm sure it's going to be, you know, uncomfortable. And although having said that, you've seen pictures of people with decent food and bunk beds and all of this business, and then you hear the fact that it's previously been used for oil workers and stuff like this in the Netherlands. And so although I don't think, obviously, it's a particularly appetizing environment. It's not a place you'd book for a holiday. It's not pleasant. To me, it's not the point. The point is that we're talking about the barge, and we've been made, I feel that we're being played for saps to talk about this bloody barge endlessly, and for people to say exactly what I've just said, it's not that bad. Why are they all moaning? Why are those dickheads going on and on about this barge when it's not that bad? Look at, you know, I've got people who are going to food banks and stuff like this. These people are being handed food for nothing, blah, blah, blah. That's what a lot of people will say and think when they hear people like us or The Guardian or the columns in the New European or whatever. They'll be thinking, those people are nuts. These asylum seekers are lucky to land here and be given accommodation. So I do really have mixed feelings about the amount of oxygen that we give this barge as a totem of the problem, because I don't think the barge is the problem. I think Suella Braverman is the problem and her utter incompetence.
I agree.
Lee Anderson is the problem because he expresses random, quite far right views.
Okay, I go along with that with the following caveat, which is that we saw how bad conditions can get at the Manston Processing Centre in Kent. We saw how bad conditions for refugees can get before Suella Braverman acts. You know, there was diphtheria, there were people sleeping in tents with no sanitation, no clothes. I'm not saying that the barge will be as bad as that. What I am saying, though, is that whilst I agree with you that we are, in a sense, and this is always a dilemma in journalism, which is, are we being manipulated? Probably. Are we, by supplying oxygen to this subject, are we playing their game? Up to a point. But I do also think that, you know, precedent with this government and the way in which it looks after, in inverted commas, refugees suggests we should keep a very close eye on conditions on that barge, because
I do agree.
I mean, that's all. But I agree with you, there is a much bigger picture here, which is that clearly border control for any mature democracy, any industrialized nation, we're a G7 nation. Any nation has to be an issue that is done fairly. You know, the rules are bound to be complex. The legal issues are complicated. What this government has done, and you're spot on to locate it in people rather than policies. You know, Braverman, Lee Anderson, Robert Jenrick, and frankly, Sunak. You know, Sunak, for all his nice guy, smiley countenance, has gone very hard on small boats from the start. And when he was running for the leadership last July, said the only thing he objected to about the Rwanda policy was it wasn't tough enough, and he came up with a more robust version of it. So these people they're playing pure culture wars with this. This is not an attempt to govern. This is an attempt to find a group of people that you can dump on. Populism thrives when you attack elites and you blame the weakest people in society for big problems. It's a disgraceful form of politics, but that's what this lot do. I keep coming back to something you said, Matt, in a I think it was a couple of episodes ago about Sunak, which is how do you sleep at night? And I really think that is now emerging as a kind of constant theme in all this.
My view on Sunak as a person is hardening by the day, and the way that he clearly is playing to any kind of policy consultancy about saying, you know, bring it back to the green crap, you know, tell people about the green crap, we're going to ban all that, tell them about the cars, you know, we're going to be the fan of the driver, tell them how much you love Disneyland, you know, tell them this, tell them how you're going to stop the boats, tell them how you're being assailed by the European Court of Human Rights, you know, all of this stuff. If I can kind of forgive Lee Anderson, because he strikes me as just a slightly jumped up thicko who has got a knack for populism and being that kind of pub bore, the kind that you go when he walks into the pub, you go, oh Christ, here he is again. You know, he's that kind of fella. I can kind of forgive Suella Braverman, because I think she is just so far out of her depth that she is just flotsam and jetsam on the tide of this dreadful conservative wave we've been subsumed by for the last few years. But I can't really forgive Rishi Sunak, because he's a smart, intelligent man, and he must know what he's doing is cheap, nasty, divisive politics, all because he can't bear the idea of personal failure, because his vanity is such that he cannot abide the idea that his great nemesis, Boris Johnson, could do populism better than he could. That's where I'm on with him at the moment. And I find it tawdry and depressing that this is the calibre of people who are running this country right now.
Well, it's also interesting, isn't it, that, I mean, it's famously a massive issue for governments. How do you renew in office? And that's a legitimate question for proper governments. This is not a proper government. This is a government that has gone through numerous iterations since 2010. You know, it's gone from the husky-hugging David Cameron of 2010 to where we are now, where, you know, the main issue this week of the being pursued by various ministers in the government with the blessing, overt blessing of the Prime Minister, is how horribly can we treat refugees? That's a big thing. And there's something extraordinary, isn't there, after 13 years, to have a government that's saying, look, you know, such failure. You know, it's not renewing government. It's redefining yourself as a single issue campaign group. Everything changed, obviously, with Brexit. But what we've seen is, as you say, the departure of Boris Johnson was meant to usher in, according to Sunak, a new age of competence and integrity and so on. And it has done no such thing. And so what you're seeing is a lower grade form of populism without the charisma, without the sort of colossal, horrifically colossal figure that Johnson cut in British politics for more than a decade. And it's just the tawdriest end to an era, I think.
Yeah, And also, again, in terms of distractions, the real stories, there's no shortage of real stories in this country about how, you know, major significant issues that need fixing. The fact that I was reading the Trussell Trust, who look after more food banks than anybody else in the country. I think they've got more than 1,000 food banks. They are saying comfortably that this winter is going to break all records for people needing to use food banks. And it's up since, hang on a sec, let me get it, a third more than the same period in 2021, 50% more than before the pandemic, people needing to use food banks in this country. The Levelling Up Fund. What happened to Levelling Up? No, that's been forgotten. They've spent less than 10% of the $5 billion they put aside for the Levelling Up Fund. That, no one talks about Levelling Up anymore. That's gone. So you've got this procession of distractions taking you away from real human crises. And meanwhile, the front pages of the Daily Mail and the Daily Express and the Telegraph or whatever are full of just stop oil because they're slowing traffic down on some high streets. If people stopped for a minute while they're stuck in those traffic jams and thought about, hold on, relatively, what are the real problems in this society? Just Stop Oil would be about number 97 of a list of 100. You know, they wouldn't even make the radar. But we are being distracted as a nation by a cynical government and an even more cynical right-wing media, I think. And it's very dangerous times.
Yes, I agree. And I think that it's the old slogan that I remember both Obama and Gordon Brown used to use, which is, how come as the issues get big, the politics get small? And I think this is a kind of very vivid example of that, sort of pathologically so, actually, which is that, as you say, you know, as the issues ahead of this country get bigger and bigger and bigger, Sunak's government is, you know, it's kind of shutting the iris of the camera of government till it's barely a pinprick. And we've talked about track B before on this podcast, which is the idea that Sunak knew that the economy wasn't going to deliver him. It wasn't going to come through in time to deliver electoral victory. And so he had to have a track B, which was basically any form of culture war you can poke a stick at. And it's just degenerated to the point where you have all the things that you mentioned, Matt. Let's not, talking about food banks, let's not forget that Lee Anderson earned his nickname 30p Lee by saying that people should be able to subsist on 30p a day. You know, an incredible thing to say, and yet it's presented by some people on his side of the Conservative Party as speaking the truth. Let's not forget that he is part of this ginger group called the New Conservatives that launched themselves, about 25 of them. They all elected in 2017, 2019, heavily concentrated in the Red Wall. They launched last month with a 12-point plan to bring down immigration by 400,000. And a lot of it involved direct attacks upon the European Convention on Human Rights. And I think for that lot, and they may not represent a majority in the parliamentary party at the moment, but they certainly represent the membership. It's an absolute cert. They want exit from ECHR to be part of the next manifesto. Now, whether it is or not, we'll see. 21st century conservatism is heading towards the exit, not just of the EU, we've done that, but from the kind of basic rule of law, minimal ethical standards that have defined Europe since the war. This is very, very big and momentous decline, kind of off the precipice, off the cliff edge of what conservatism means. Because we can all remember conservatives who would be absolutely appalled at that, but they've all been purged from the party.
Yeah, and your point is so well made about 30p Lee, and we did a front page of the New European the week before last with a pastiche of Barbie with Suella Braverman and a few accoutrements, sort of like you know, a blue passport and some barbed wire and various devices to stop refugees and asylum seekers. And instead of Barbie, it said barbaric. And it was presented as though that was the gift box. And I sent it to our fellow podcaster and new European editor-at-large, Alistair Campbell, and said, what do you think of this? Do you think it works? And he said, I love it. The problem is she'll love it too. Mm. And this is, you know, this is the salient point, is that they want to be seen in this light. I'll bet you every time Lee Anderson sees 30p Lee trending on Twitter,
he must love it.
He loves it. Because, like I said at the beginning, you know, bleeding heart liberals complaining about something equals his folk cheering about something. That's how they see it. And this is when people talk about culture wars, this we've got to be very careful about not being played and about not falling into the trap of, one, stereotyping them, characterising them as sincere bigots, because they're much worse than that. They are cryptically cynical bigots. And secondly, we've got to be very careful about sticking to the facts, you know, and keep bringing people back to what's actually happening, and not the headlines on the Daily Mail, but the reality, and looking for information in places that aren't as shouty as Mail Online or the front page of the Express. But keep it on the facts. The facts are, 5 years ago, there were 40,000 asylum seekers having their asylum processed. Now there's more than 160,000. Who is responsible for that? Suella Braverman. End of story.
No, I agree with all of that.
And on that bombshell,
let's take a break.
Let's come back with something a little bit lighter, cultural.
Yeah.
Not culture wars, great culture.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
So, Matt, a sad week in many ways for radical culture.
Yeah.
Which, let me throw it to you. Like, let me throw you that ball.
Well, you may or may not have noticed I'm wearing my Anarchy in the UK t-shirt. And this is in honour of Jamie Reid, who I would be surprised if a huge proportion of our listeners have heard of, but he's a very important artist. He died this week, aged I think 76, and he was a great friend of Malcolm McLaren, the Sex Pistols manager, and he basically designed the visual identity of Sex Pistols and of punk. And so this T-shirt was appeared on the cover of the single Anarchy in the UK when it came out in, I think, 1976. And he did the famous, and here's my, I'm doing a lot of merch today. This is a merch week. Here's my God Save the Queen mug. And he redefined design in all sorts of ways. He used the cut up letters that were used by blackmailers and in a way that harked back to Dada art, but also became mainstream. And it's interesting because I can, if I wore this T-shirt in 1976, I'd have had my head kicked in. I can go to the shops. I can go anywhere. I can go to the opera wearing this T-shirt now because it's been, the ideas he came up with came into the mainstream. And it's very interesting when people you haven't heard of necessarily have a big impact upon the world around you. And we were talking about this before the podcast, which is another guy, a giant of cinema, who again is less well known now than he was, say, 30 years ago. William Friedkin. What did he do? Well, he made two all-time classics films. First, The French Connection, 1971, starring Gene Hackman as Popeye Doyle and Roy Scheider as Claudio Russo, which is the absolute archetypal gritty cop movie. In fact, should we ask our glorious producer Matt Hill to rustle up a bit of a clip from that film?
Come on, move out! Can't face the window.
Move,
face the wall. Turn around.
Move,
come on,
move.
Hands out of your pocket.
Turn around.
Come on, you heart. Come on.
Turn around.
Get on the wall.
Get on.
Turn around.
Hey,
you
drop that.
Pick it up.
Come on, move.
What are you looking at?
So there you get a picture of...
Absolutely brilliant.
Isn't it brilliant? I mean, you get a picture of...
A
completely new way of doing cop movies. And cop movies that involved really hardcore drug deals. This is back in 1971, 52 years ago. If The French Connection had never existed, I'm not saying these shows would never have happened, but they might have been very different. The Wire, Narcos, Fargo, a film like Seven. All these movies were really, really defined by what Billy Friedkin achieved in The French Connection. And it's interesting because I don't think he's as well remembered now as he was, say, in the 90s, but his influence is everywhere.
I remember a great quote from him where he said, because he started out making documentaries, TV documentaries, and he said that what he wanted to bring to the film, but he didn't know if it was possible, but he wanted to bring to the film the idea that the camera didn't know what was going to happen next. And that's exactly the feel you get watching The French Connection. Is it's all over the place. Everything's happening. You know, it's kind of, it's almost like it's a surprise to the cameraman that something's just happened. And that sense of vitality, but the language as well, there's sort of a great screenwriter as well, you know. And of course, his other big, massive monster hit was The Exorcist.
2 years later, 50 years ago, here comes on Boxing Day, 1973, comes The Exorcist, which... I went to see it again just before Christmas, and it is still very scary. And it has not lost its power. The special effects are horrific. They look a bit sketchy compared to today's CGI, but so what? It's half a century ago. It still makes an audience gasp. It's about for those who haven't seen it, it's about a 12-year-old girl played by Linda Blair, who is... possessed by a demon in Georgetown in Washington. And her mother's a screen actress, Chris McNeil, played by Ellen Burstyn. And they go through this ghastly sort of process of trying to diagnose what's wrong with Regan through the medical procedures and they come up with nothing. And so in desperation, Chris McNeil, the mother, goes to a priest called Damien Karras, who's wonderfully played by a guy who was pretty much an unknown, called Jason Miller. And to cut a long story short, they do perform an exorcism. They bring in Max von Sydow, who I discovered not long ago was only 44 when he played the old priest. So it's pretty impressive. And the film is about that kind of battle between the old priest and the young priest, trying to defeat evil and cast the demon out of Regan. It's a very simple plot in a way, but it's incredibly powerful, and it just blew away audiences. I mean, there were queues around the block for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it's interesting. It's a seriously good film. And it's still, again, it like The French Connection, and this comes back to how people you might not have heard of define the world around you. The horror genre was completely rewritten by The Exorcist. So if you're going to, a lot of people will go and see the 10th installment of the Saw franchise when it opens next month or in October. It's around then. And that's a fairly schlocky, ordinary franchise, but that would be unthinkable without the world of The Exorcist. You know, the world The Exorcist created is the world in which The Omen, The Amityville Horror, there was a dreadful film this year called The Pope's Exorcist, starring Russell Crowe, which, you know, had
with Russell Crowe
starring, which really, you know, I mean, what a ripoff. And it had words that aren't used anymore, but straight to video written all over it. But it's still going. And I noticed, poor William Friedkin, that they've been trying to squeeze juice out of the Exorcist franchise, which should never have been a franchise. And they're trying again and bringing back Ellen Burstyn, who was in the original, to do a new trilogy starting later this year with Exorcist Believer. And you watch the trailer and you don't want to see the movie. It is just embarrassing. But what it shows is that someone who, again, has been really off the... It's a long while since Friedkin made a movie of any substance. Probably Killer Joe in 2011 with Matthew McConaughey. You know, even now, and I bet when the news of his death broke, a lot of people barely noticed it. And yet, they'll be going to Cineplexes later this year or watching streaming things online that are absolutely drenched with his influence. And we were talking about this earlier, it's like a very interesting phenomenon, because we're so used to thinking about the now, the next big thing, what's going on, the contemporary. Digital culture makes us think like that, and actually culture doesn't really work like that, does it?
I was thinking about people who changed genre, you know, or synthesized genres and created something new, or just changed how we think about something cultural. And I came up with a little list of my top five.
Oh, great.
People who I think... So in reverse order, but no particular order. First one, Oprah Winfrey. Right. A news reporter given a 30-minute show to talk about stuff to people in Chicago, and basically creates the talk show, which is now, you know, one of the dominant forms of popular entertainment, and I mean, and still going strong, and the world's first black billionaire, by the way. Mm-hmm. It just fascinatingly. Yeah. So I thought Alfred Hitchcock, as a body of work, you know, for and such an amazing touch for horror, for suspense, for comedy as well, you know, but great, amazing. I think it was Friedkin who said, he said to film students, I thought this applies to journalism students as well. He said, the first thing I tell film students to do is get out of film school. He said, just because they'll teach you all of the ordinary, you know, they'll teach you the standard. But what you want to do is go and watch everything Hitchcock shot. And within that body of work is everything you need to know about making amazing movies. So I thought that was fascinating. Bill Shankly. Do you know who Bill Shankly is, Matt?
I do. Former manager of Liverpool, one of the greats. There we go. But are you proud?
I'm delighted. He created created the spirit of Liverpool Football Club, who I love so much. Although I must confess, my dad, who was 90 this week, and
oh, happy
had a
birthday.
Great party with also a Two Mats listener. Thank you very much. Two Matt's listener, my auntie, his sister, Sheila Reed. Hello, Sheila.
Hi, Sheila.
Both big Everton fans. And my favourite Bill Shankly quote is not the one about football's not a matter of life and death. I can assure you it's much more serious than that. My favourite quote is,
If Everton were playing at the bottom of my garden, I'd shut the curtains.
Maybe that might have come out a bit more Clint Eastwood than Bill Shankly.
But that's actually quite good to have him as Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. But then a guy who you and I will definitely both know, but will probably be a new name to a lot of listeners, Hugh Cudlip, Hugh Cudlip in the 1950s basically he invented popular tabloid journalism, not in the sense that the sleazy sense that some people might associate it with now, but in the sense that a mainstream media that was talking to people, and he invented the modern Daily Mirror, and it was all about being anti-establishment and speaking for the working classes, and it was an absolute first, and the use of great photography in newspapers. Hugh Cudlip basically invented the concept of about 85% of what you now think of as newspaper media, and of course that's bled into online as well. But my number one is our great friend of the show, Pablo Picasso, because I don't think, and I thought about this long and hard, I don't think in the history of any culture or art or anything, any of the humanities, has been a man, for all his faults, who reinvented the format through sheer energy and boredom, reinvented what he did and cast aside enormous success to do something new. I think Picasso stands alone at the top of a mountain of cultural gods, for me, anyway.
I love that. Shall I provide my own five?
Please.
Okay.
Please.
The most sentimental of them all is Martin Amis, because I think that he's unfashionable at the moment, and when he died, I thought Will Self did a fantastic piece for the New European on that. Really, really strong. He knew Martin very well. But at the moment, his work is not in the greatest of sort of, you know, it doesn't have as many accolades as it did in the past, because we're going through an era where that kind of very masculine voice just doesn't have as many takers. But he was a great, great essayist, and he completely imported the American style of high art autobiography that people like Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and others had perfected, and brought it into this country's literature. And it's still there. And what's interesting is that quietly, because it's not cool or woke to advertise your love of Martin Amis, people are still reading him. And I think he'll last. That's number one. Number two, also a little bit of sentimentality, but I think I'm confident about this, was Jamie Reid's great friend Malcolm McLaren, who we mentioned earlier, whom I was very lucky to know and hilariously advised on his bid to become mayor of London in 2000. We got to 6%.
No.
We got to 6%.
Did you really?
Yeah, we got to 6% in the polls, and at that point I thought, that'll do, Malcolm. And he, you know, he very gracefully stood aside, I think, and he backed Ken. Anyway, Malcolm was an amazing character and also a brilliant synthesist, and best known for the Sex Pistols, but he did so much more, including, you know, Launch Boy George, Bow Wow Wow, Give Adamant His New Image, and then become a very successful solo artist. And one of the things he did, an album that's just been re-released, Duck Rock, basically he went around the world hoovering up all of these new world music influences, including very early understanding of hip-hop and b-boys and so on, and a lot of stuff on that album is now kind of standard fare in world music. So it's just a groundbreaking genius, in my view. So that's two. Number three, I've got to say Toni Morrison, because I think that her novels, particularly Beloved, to say they raise the African-American voice, it just doesn't cover how amazing and expansive they were. Yes, they did do that, and she was a publisher who became an author. She absolutely fills the skyline of late 20th century writing. And, you know, every single novel she wrote was brilliant. And she was a feminist and a civil rights campaigner. And, you know, but also the aesthetic she created on the page was just mind-blowing. And I think she will last. She's a classic. Fourth, Jan Venner, because I think that Rolling Stone, long past its best now, but But when he founded that magazine, it absolutely captured the zeitgeist of the rock and roll era, where, and he understood and foretold the extent to which culture and politics would become enmeshed. So he'd send Truman Capote off to hang out with the Rolling Stones, but he'd also send Hunter S. Thompson to go on the election trail. And the best of Wenner's Rolling Stone is really what modern long-form journalism is all about, which is what's the kind of the borderlands between culture and politics. Rolling Stone is not the magazine he founded at all anymore, but at its height it was just absolutely sublime. And the last one I think one should mention, given that we're doing a podcast, is Joe Rogan, who, for all his faults and for all the mistakes he's made about, particularly during COVID, has completely revolutionized this form. He's a long-form interviewer, that's it. He's, as we know, a stand-up comedian. He's also, oddly enough, he's a martial artist of great distinction, but he's a brilliant and curious interviewer. And it took him a while to get there, but he's completely, or almost single-handedly, invented the long-form interview podcast. And it's incredible. I mean, you know, he can get anyone he wants in the world. He turned down Trump because he felt that to let Trump onto his show would be to give him oxygen. But his interview with Robert Kennedy Jr. was listened to, I think, by 40 or 50 million people, which just knocks all of the cable news channels in the States, you know, out of the park. His arguably...
That's a great list.
I mean, arguably, Rogan is the most influential media figure in the world at the moment. That's not a popular view in the circles we move.
What, including the two, Matt?
Well, look, I mean, he... The number, I can't get him off the phone, right? He wants to be a guest. I said, Joe, you know, you have to wait your turn, mate, you know? But he's a big fan, of course.
That's
he's
a massive brilliant fan. List, Matt. What didn't we talk about?
To go back to something you quite rightly mentioned, Matt, about real subjects. Today, Thursday, it was announced that people waiting for hospital treatment has hit a record high of 7.6 million. And already government's blaming it on the striking health workers, but it's worth pointing out that it was already 7.2 million in January. Now, some of this is COVID, but essentially, and it returns to the point that we keep making, that it goes back to a government that is simply not willing to engage with the structural realities of the world in which we live.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, more depressingly, you saw... forecast for a huge uptick in mortgage arrears, and there'll be a proportion of those that end up in repossession, I'm sure, although hopefully not as bad as it used to be in the late 70s, early 80s, but more bad news down the pipe. So anyway, just to reinforce, there are no shortage of real material stories that do not involve a handful of asylum seekers on a barge that we need to make a conscious effort to talk about more.
One story that amused me, I don't know if you saw it, Matt, but it really is squarely in the new European wheelhouse, was, and I think we need to page Dr. Freud on this one, which is that at 10:20 a.m. this morning, Downing Street tweeted that the UK was, and I'm quoting, home to twice as many AI companies as any other EU country. And I think this is the subconscious of the government wishing it hadn't done what it did. We're still in the EU. And the tweet was amended to any EU country at 11:06, 46 minutes later.
Do you think we could just identify as an EU country?
I think we could. It's
could we just make
like
that
a, like a, what you mean, like a membership reveal party? You know, Rishi Sunak would just have us a little party at the...
We've now decided to identify as a European Union country, having decided that being on our own was a really shit
idea. So it would be LGBTQIEU.
Yeah, there we go. No, on dangerous ground now, which is where I'd like to be, so that's fine.
This week's cancellation, folks, for anyone who was wondering... Right.
And remember, folks, the latest edition of The New European is on newsstands now. It's our double summer edition. It's jam-packed of absolutely brilliant journalism and a good distraction from all the aggro in the world, although we do cover some of the aggro. And that you can find that on newsstands everywhere. And it's also on our website, which is theneweuropean.co.uk. And podcast listeners can have a great deal on a subscription. Just head to theneweuropean.co.uk/2MATS. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. And there's a link in the show notes. And every new subscriber, I will personally provide you with a very high quality Bollocks to Brexit passport cover worth $24.99, absolutely free of charge, with your wonderful New European, which you can get for just £1 a week.
Bargain. Talk
about great value. Thanks again to the third Matt, producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.